Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal's third annual opening day baseball show. I never thought we'd hit three on this, Doctor and I. We're joined by Dr. Rich and I, who I saw pitch, the 69, 68 Cubs.
When you were a kid, right?
When I was a kid, yeah. There's so many things I want to talk to you about. Thank you for coming in. I know this weekend I might have gone if I didn't have to be here. They're having some exhibition games in Montreal. They're playing, I think it's Toronto and
sure.
Pittsburgh, maybe.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. And you ended your career in Montreal in 1970.
Right.
So two questions. What was it like to play there, and do you think they're ready for Major League Baseball again there?
Well, I went up there and no one knew who I was, but the fact that I was a Montreal Expo made me extremely special. And you'd go into restaurants and people would give you, you know, free meals, and it just created an awful lot of attention. I didn't know at the time that the fans really understood baseball that much. I do remember one night we had a doubleheader and it was raining. And so they called the game. Rain out. So 15, 20 minutes go by, and someone popped their head out to look at the stands, and the stands are still filled with fans. And someone walked up to him and says, what are you all sitting there waiting for? They called the game. He says, yeah, well, they called the first game. We're just waiting for the second one to start.
Was that what park? Now, my Montreal history,
Jerry Park.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I remember seeing that. So, do you think they could have it again?
I think so. I think they've had enough experience with baseball in their history, and I think the Expos were extremely popular. I think people loved them, and they had really some outstanding players come out of there. One of their general managers, I think, was Bill Stoneman,
mm-hmm. Former Cub.
And a teammate of mine, and you know, no hitters and that kind of thing, and he helped build that while they still had the franchise there.
And of course, one of their players is going to the Hall of Fame this year, Tim Raines.
Sure.
And I remember that outfield just sitting in the bleachers at Wrigley when they'd come to town. I believe it was maybe at one point it was Raines, Dawson, and Ellis Valentine.
Right.
Pretty interesting. Who were some of your teammates in Montreal? Was Coco LeBoy still around?
Coco LeBoy, yeah. Absolutely.
That's a great name, Dan Long. Yeah. Coco LeBoy.
Ron Fairley. Sutherland. Second baseman Sutherland.
Oh, yeah.
Bobby Wine, shortstop. Bob Bailey, I mentioned him. I'm trying to think of the pitchers.
And they were expansion team.
Oh, totally. Yeah. They started out in 19, I think 68 was the first year they had the expansion. And then most of the names were not real well. No, we had Rusty Staub. He was our star.
Le Grand Orange
was our star. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We had Ron was a giant. Used to get hit all the
Ron
time.
Ron Hunt.
You got it. Mm-hmm. Thank you. This is good. Yeah. See, I'm at the age that I forget.
I should be on the beat.
I forget names. You should. Yes, you should.
Ron Hunt. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's tough. Now, we were talking off the air. I thought it was real interesting. Your manager, let's do Gene Mauch 101. Gene Mauch was your manager.
Yes.
1964, managed the Phillies, one of the all-time flops. I don't want to say choke, but one of the all-time flops in baseball history.
Right.
What was it like to play for Gene Mauch as a pitcher?
Well, I remember one thing he said to me after it took a long time warming up for a game and went about four or five innings, didn't throw real well. And after the game, the trainer told him, oh, yeah, his arm is bothering him. Well, he called me into the office after that and said, you know, I don't like sore arm pitchers. And I said, well, you know, that was my history before I was brought up. I said, I had hurt something in my shoulder, had some therapy, treatment, whatever, pitched a good ball game down there, and then I was brought up. And I wasn't taken care of as they would take care of someone nowadays. Because nowadays, they've got this huge investment in these players, and they have to keep them healthy. They can't let some pitcher go out and strain a groin muscle and be out of the lineup for 6 weeks. They mm-hmm. can't allow that. So mm-hmm. when it hurts, they rest them. But, you know, when I played, you spit a little tobacco juice on it and go out and throw. And if you came up with a sore arm, they'd say, well, just you could throw it out. Throw it against a wall and, you know, it'll work its way out. Of course, it's a torn rotator cuff. All it does is tear a little bit more, and
yeah,
pretty
yeah.
soon you're out. But they didn't have the investment, and there were lots of people that wanted to take your spot. So they just move them in.
How did he handle pitchers, though? You were talking about the 64 Phillies. Of course, you weren't a member of that team, but you were talking about how maybe he only used two pitchers down the stretch. I think it's interesting what you were talking about when we were on the break about how you manage maybe one way. This is kind of true in the NBA, too. I mean, it's coaching styles. Manage one way in the regular season, and things kind of change in
the
playoffs.
Well, and just to draw an analogy, in 64, I don't know, honestly, if Gene Mauch had been on a team that was vying for the championship, but he's got an 8-game lead with 10 games to go, and he's got a great pitching staff, a strong depth in the pitching staff, but he went to his first and second starters back and forth and back and forth for 4 games, and they lost 8 games straight, and ended up losing in the last couple days of the season.
Cardinals, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so if we go to this last year, just looking at, in fact, both managers on both teams, I know they've been there before. So
you're talking about the World Series?
I'm not sure what it was, the World Series. Mm-hmm. But, you know, get into game 6 where let's just say it was getting tight, okay? And they look at that and you say, okay, this is the way you've handled your team and your managers. It was just go out and play ball. And when they weren't doing the job, you put someone else in. You've got someone backing up. You know what it's going to do. But you don't think about what you're going to do ahead of time. You don't have the game planned out, mapped out. And that's what it looked like both managers were doing. It was different. Now,
Game 6, really, with the Cubs, really
it,
was wild.
Yeah, I have
really
to
bothered
say,
me.
I went through an entire bottle of wine that night, I believe. high and low and high and low, and Game 7 was without a doubt the best baseball game I've ever watched. It was just so exciting. And the fact that the Cubs won was the topper. But still watching it, it was how he was moving players in and out, and I was going, this is not the same guy. He was successful, can't knock the success, but I wanted him to get back to that thing that makes the players more comfortable. You know, when you have a certain way of doing things, which he does.
Joe, you're talking about
Joe. Yeah, Joe. You watch him handle the players on the field. These guys are going to stand in front of a bus for him. That's the impression I get.
Oh, great people person. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. He knows how to manage personalities, which a lot of managers were put in that position in the old days because they have a history of being a tough guy like Leo DeRocher, you know. Loudmouth or whatever it was, and not necessarily understanding the personalities he was trying to deal with. But that's what I want to see. I want to see him keep working those personalities and not put so much pressure on them when it's not necessary to do that.
You've stayed in the Chicago area most of your life after baseball? I mean,
I did.
The practice
yes.
and all that. So you mentioned something. I thought this was interesting, too. I wanted you to talk about it. Do you think that is a result of knowing, especially with the Cubs, the daunting thing up until last year of playing under all this pressure of just having 108 years of not winning?
Well, you know, if you read Chicago history and you read why Phil Wrigley bought the Cubs in the first place and built Wrigley Field, and it was all about he wanted to have a place where families could go out and have a nice time on the weekend. It wasn't about winning ball games. It wasn't about putting the best team on the field. It was just like he wanted a nice park where people could go out and they could watch baseball. And for when I joined the Cubs, that was sort of the attitude. Let's play two today. Let's go out and play two today. Don't care whether we win or lose, but we're just going to entertain the folks. And I think getting the new management in, when we saw the changes that he made with Boston, and he's coming to us, and we saw that, and then saw him making changes and saying, well, geez, young guy, he probably knows what he's doing. Let's just see, because he's had a good track record. It was so different than any management that I've seen with the Cubs, and I've liked a bunch of their managers and general managers, respect them as baseball people, but it was, again, how they handled the personalities bringing with those personalities the performance. When you play it right, you get the performance.
How engaged, at that point in his career, how engaged was Leo DeRocher?
Well, he was engaged to, what was her name now?
Goldblatt. Goldblatt.
Yeah, Lynn yeah. Walker Goldblatt. Yeah, right. I remember that. Yeah. Yes, and he had a little party out of town one weekend.
Lake Geneva, right?
Yeah, and everybody was upset, and he let the team down, and you know, we were cheering and roaring in the clubhouse. We were having a good time. So that didn't bother us. It bothered the fans. It bothered the press because they wanted to find something wrong with Leo and you know, get his goat if they could. Everybody wanted to because he played that card all the time, you know, the tough guy.
Yeah, yeah. One more thing on Gene Mock for listeners who, when some of the issues came up with Joe during the postseason and the way he was handling the pitching staff, I did read stuff about, you know, he was a big fan of Gene Mock. They came up in the Angels organization together after Gene, I think, I don't know if Gene managed in the Angels, but I know he's in some position with the Angels and stuff. Talk about some of these. I didn't even know about. You were telling me about some of the innovations Gene Mock did. When was he doing this at Montreal when you played for him?
When I joined the team there, I don't think I'd ever seen. You know, he had pitchers when I was with the Cubs. You'd chart a game. You know, chart a game. It was like you're sitting back there, you're talking, and you know, you're trying to keep track of the pitches, and the idea is you're putting down which pitch, what the count was, where was the pitch, and off-speed, fastball, curveball, whatever. And you try and see that from home plate. Of course, you don't always catch every single one. But I went up to Montreal, and Mock had a notebook, you know, a spiral notebook.
Yeah.
And it had players against this pitcher, against that pitcher, against this pitcher, and it had where did the balls go that they hit, and those were all marked, and what were outs and what were hits. And
this is 1970 he was
this
doing
is it. 1970. Yeah. And he was charting pitches. He was reading signals from the opposing pitcher. You could see what, you know, how he was holding the ball when he wound up, and if he was like giving away a curveball or a changeup or something. And he could call out a signal if you were interested as a hitter, you wanted to know what was coming. Some Wow. hitters do, some hitters don't. But the bottom line is he kept track of all these things. And when you're out there pitching, you aren't aware that he's sitting there in the dugout and he's waving to every one of the fielders to move them around to put them in the right spot. Yeah. And to prove that that is his thinking, you'd look at all the balls, you know, they'd be, you give up a hit off the bat, goes to your right side, and you turn around, you say, well, that's through there, and it's right at the shortstop, and you go, I didn't know he was playing in that position, you know.
We got to take a break here. I want to talk about the Cubs' afterglow years, but do you remember who your pitching coach was in Montreal? I'm pretty good on recall, but I'm just
Cal McClish.
Cal McClish. Okay. All right.
We'll be with both hands.
We'll be back with Dr. Rich Nye and our baseball special on Nocturnal Journal after this. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720 with Dr. Rich Nye. That 1969 team, I was 14 years old, and it made me into the cynical guy I was until last year. Now it's all over. I'm a happy man.
I feel the same.
I tried to tell Dan that he didn't have to go through all that suffering. And
yeah. Like, oh, my
it
God.
It was awful. It was just broke my heart.
And when I think back 50 years for me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Anyway.
I want to talk about the Cubs, but I don't want to lose this thought. We were just talking. Tell the Cal McClish story about him. His background in baseball. What happened to him?
He was a pitching coach for Montreal when I went there.
Okay.
And he was a right-handed pitcher and very effective major league right-handed pitcher. And he was with the Philadelphia Phillies for 4 years and X number of days. But at that time, in order to be qualified for a pension, you needed 5 years. And he got close to it, and they sent him down to the minor leagues. And he was in the minor leagues for at least 4 years before he got back to the big leagues. And I'm not sure if he came back as a player or he came back as a manager. I'm trying to remember. But he went down into the minor leagues and was there for 4 years winning 20 games, I think, almost every year. And he had arm trouble with one arm, so he threw with his other arm.
Really?
Yeah.
He threw with both arms?
Left hand, and threw hard throw.
So one arm went bad, and he started throwing with the other arm. He still was a winning pitcher.
And he's still a winning pitcher.
And
he's
all in the minor leagues.
And this is in the minor leagues. And he won these 20 games 3 or 4 years in a row, and the Phillies never brought him up.
They never brought him up.
No.
And so for listeners who don't know that era of baseball, talk about the control the owners had.
Well, the reserve clause had an awful lot to say about it. And a young fellow that was on my rookie card, John Upham.
I remember him. Yeah.
Johnny was an outfielder turned pitcher, and he broke camp with us in 67. He broke camp with us, and both he and I were in the bullpen, soon to be given a starting chance, but we were in the bullpen, and we both had these little clauses in our contract, getting the minimum salary. We had to stay 60 consecutive days in order to get paid the full salary. And with me, I also had a progressive bonus that was based on that same stipulation. I had to spend, I think, 90 straight days consecutive. So what they would do to the players, if they thought they were borderline, they would send you down for a weekend and then bring you back up. So you'd have to start your consecutive days all over again.
I didn't know that.
So I remember John and I were counting the days. He's lockered near me or next to me, or we sat in the bullpen talking all the time. And he says, you know, it's day 59. I says, yeah, it is. He got called into the game that day, had a bad outing, pitched one or two innings and gave up a couple of runs, a couple of hits, whatever. And they sent him down, and he never got back the big leagues. That was it.
That was it.
But they had the control. And you know, if you didn't want to abide by that, and you didn't want to sign a contract, but you had signed a contract with them previously, they owned you. So you couldn't just wait a year, take a year off, and then go sign with somebody else. You couldn't work out with anybody else, nothing.
I mean, it's Curt Flood should be in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
It changed what he did. The stand that he took changed the face of baseball.
It did.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of my college teammates was the fellow that was – one of those that broke that reserve clause, Andy Messersmith.
Andy Messersmith, yeah, pitcher. Yeah.
And, you know, it was just like, if you don't follow the rules, and he found a clause in the contract that was in his favor, didn't have a leg to stand on to follow it.
So you watch the Cubs. How does it feel to be a former Cub and now have them conquered this?
Well,
I don't want to call it a curse, but
well,
let's get this thing
something,
over with.
It was absolutely exciting. The whole season was thrilling. Watching the guys perform, watching the fans come out and give them the support they needed, and watching the manager all season long not take it to his head and just go out and play ball. I mean, guys would make an error, whoop-de-doo.
Yeah, it's right.
Like, you don't make a big thing out of anything. You just say, we're here to play baseball, and we want to play following the right rules, learning the basic fundamentals. Let's just do it right, and let's just have fun.
Yeah.
And, boy, they did. They went out and had fun.
It was a great year. You want to hang around a little bit?
Absolutely.
You're great. Every time I bring up a story, you have something. I mean, we're going to talk about Lefty O'Doul, so you have a Lefty O'Doul story. So, maybe throw in some questions and ride along with us.